Welcome to the AJP podcast, a podcast that discusses current events, relevant topics, and emerging issues in pharmacy. I'm your host, Carlene McMoore, and together with my producer, Jared McMoore, and the Australian Journal of Pharmacy, we are bringing you a podcast that draws on the opinions and expertise of pharmacists from all settings and experience levels. From those pharmacists who've already been a voice in the profession to those who've never had their voice heard before. This is the first episode in a series that will include the thoughts of our guests on the current state of pharmacy, where this has come from, and where it is going in the future. Shane Jackson discusses the Work Valley case and how it has led to a clear identification of the breadth and depth of pharmacy practice. He also discusses the need for pharmacists to be enabled to be responsible for medicine safety.
It's a very good question, and it's something I've actually analysed quite significantly with regards to the work value case that was presented in the Fair Work Commission not so long ago. And like I said, so I've actually done a lot of serious thinking about the role, and it needs to be divided up into breadth of activity and depth of performance. So the breadth of our activity over the last 20 years hasn't really changed, so the breadth. Probably the only real addition has been vaccination from a breadth point of view. But it's actually the level of responsibility and the depth of performance of the roles that has changed. And I'll articulate those in a number of examples. But things like home medicines reviews, meds checks, stage supply, dose administration aids, absence from work certificates, they all have frameworks for practice, so the professional practice standards, the standards and guidelines by the society about how they're delivered and what needs to occur. Now, prior, you know, if you look 20 years ago, pharmacists may well have been sitting down with patients and doing consultations, but not in a formalised structure and not matched to a performance level that that is remunerated and that delivers a specific health outcome or educational or addresses an educational need. So it's the depth of performance that actually has changed. And that goes to a lot of the words that I've been talking about over the last year or so, which is responsibility and accountability for medicines management. That's where I see pharmacy evolving to. Currently, we've got an issue with medicine safety in Australia. You know, we've got the oft-quoted phrase around 230,000 hospital admissions related to medication misadventure cost the healthcare system $1.2 billion annually. That doesn't include the general practice appointments or community pharmacy visits because of, other medication-related issues. So we actually have an epidemic of medication safety issues. And so I ask the question, which health professional group is taking responsibility and accountability for medicine safety? And I will tell you that there is no group who is being either facilitated or responsible for medicine safety. Now, we've got doctors, we've got nurses, we've got pharmacists, and medicine safety, those issues, are just almost sitting in the middle. And there's no other ideal health professional group to actually have, to be empowered to have that responsibility and accountability for medicine safety. So my view is that we actually tackle that issue by saying we want pharmacists to be responsible and accountable for medicine safety. And if that's our objective, then we put in the system enablers, and so that's structural, regulatory, legislative, and the funding systems to actually enable that. That's where I see pharmacists' role heading, in that we address the medicine safety issue that we have and we actually provide leadership in addressing that. It's a health epidemic. And so that accountability actually comes, Jared, from having a framework in place that says this is how we want pharmacists to be responsible and accountable, and this is how we're going to make them accountable. So that quality framework, and I've talked about quality in practice because through our consultations that we did with members on pharmacists in 2023, quality and integrity in practice was a key component. So they want responsibility, but they want to make sure that the entire profession, if we take on that responsibility, which we want to and we desire to, but that we all do it to the standard to which health professionals, patients, governments and our entire profession expects. It's a professional practice issue. So we have professional practice standards that say how those services need to be delivered at the pharmacist level. Right? So what we're actually talking about, let's not worry about the entity, is actually these are pharmacists delivering services that we might expect is a deviation from accepted professional practice. So we've got the professional practice standards there and we've got the standards and guidelines for whatever that service is. We just need to ensure that that is delivered how the government believes they're being delivered and how the government is funding them to deliver a certain outcome. And so from our point of view, it's really about giving the standards and guidelines and the professional practice standards some teeth because it is a professional issue.
I talk about how the implementation of pharmacist vaccinators show pharmacies' capacity to take on future roles despite misplaced external scrutiny.
When I think about the implementation of the vaccinations, and I'm very proud of the pharmacy workforce for how they all took it on board, how many pharmacists went to do the training, how many immunizations and vaccinations were done in pharmacies, and I'm really impressed with how, as a group and as a professional body, this was all taken on board. Unfortunately, with all of this progress, there's always going to be a lot of challenges and a lot of speculation, a lot of extra observation on us and a lot of extra focus to make sure that we can do it the right way. So what I would say is, as the future continues, there'll be more and more opportunities to challenge the current status quo of what a pharmacist is. And I believe that with these growing opportunities and pharmacists taking these opportunities and doing them as well as they have with the vaccinations, I believe that the future is wide open. And I think, unfortunately, it does take into consideration that there will be pushback and there will be people questioning us more and there will be having to prove ourselves more. And I would say if we handle it the same way as we did with the vaccinations and the immunisations, then the future is very bright for us.
Jacinta Johnson compares the evolution of the APF to the evolution of pharmacy practice.
I often think about the past sort of aspects of the pharmacy profession and where we're going when I look back through the old APFs. So I've got quite a collection and I love reading about what was sort of expected of the pharmacist back when the APF first started. And it really was a list of instructions of how the pharmacist can do what the doctors want us to do to the letter, basically. It was a lot of formulations. And if you look at the APF now, it's still got some formulations in there, but it's changed completely. And I think that reflects the way the pharmacist role has changed over time as well. And you see in there now lots of guidelines around clinical decisions that we make in the over-the-counter counselling guides and things like that. And I think looking forward, we'll see even more of that, a move to the pharmacist role really focusing on clinical decision-making and helping other health professionals to navigate those areas of grey around medicines rather than just following sort of wrote protocols or instructions from other health professionals.
And Jacinta, for the record, how many APFs do you have?
I think I need 5 more.
Ooh, and then you complete the collection.
Then I've got the set. Yeah.
Carolyn Huxhagen notes that what was old is new again, including compounding, which has a new life due to pharmacogenomics.
Well, because I'm an older pharmacist, my past pharmacy, we still did a lot of extemporaneous preparations. My first pharmacy I worked in still had a basic typewriter and our labels were sticky labels that you put through a water bath. So that's how elderly I am. But I think there's a lot of it comes around in a circle thing in pharmacy too. So extemporaneous for me was a huge part of what I learnt in the beginning, And now we've moved into compounding, which is a huge avenue and specialty area of practice for pharmacy, and a very much needed area of practice, because compounding enables us now to move into the area of genomics and, you know, specialty, you know, drilling down to specialising medicines to be specific to the patient. And so I think even some of our older technologies are going to enable us to be futuristic pharmacists, where, you know, you'll come in with your medicines will be designed for your specific disease states. It won't be a haphazard. So I think pharmacy is expanding into interesting areas, and I spend a lot of time, because I work with GPs quite closely in a lot of my work, and I spend a lot of time demythicising some of their beliefs in what pharmacy is trying to do to them. And so I think we're evolving to be at the level of health practitioner that we truly are. But we've always, we went through this phase of being shop retailers, shopkeepers, you know, the seller of the toilet paper and the Nescafe. But we're now evolving out of that into being recognised health professionals. So I think we've come from, you know, the apothecary stage, we went into this retailer shopping sort of environment, and now we're coming out into the other area. But there's many, many versions of pharmacy. And I was in Japan last year, and I was just interested to see that in Japan they have three types of pharmacy particularly. So they have the pharmacies that sell everything from, you know, toilet paper to Cupid dolls to any kind of play equipment, you know, glitters, whatever. Then you have the pharmacy that has the pharmacist in it and, you know, gives you the medicines and works with the prescription in a limited capacity. And then they have the truly traditional pharmacy, where you sit down and they compound up the medicine for you based on their pharmacopeia knowledge as to your medical condition. So I think there's a place for all three forms of pharmacy, but I hope that we're actually on this upward curve of being recognised as truly health practitioners.
Mark Norton talks about the need to turn pockets of highly collaborative work into widespread practice excellence.
When I first came into pharmacy, I actually expected that we were at a stage of practice that we're still hoping to get to. And that was actually one of the reasons that I did the PhD that I did, was to try and develop the evidence base around some of the activities around medication review. I kind of already thought that pharmacists were already providing high-level advice to doctors. And I graduated, and that simply wasn't the case. And even in a hospital setting where I thought that was more advanced, that really wasn't the case. It was in pockets, but it wasn't widespread. So I think the past was perhaps misleading in some ways. Graduate students that pharmacists were undertaking roles more regularly than they actually were, and perhaps students coming into the degrees are still under that impression, and I still see that we haven't reached our full potential. We know we haven't reached our full potential. And so although there's been good change in the 20 or so years that I've been involved in pharmacy, the thing that keeps me quite enthused and why I like my job is that I can see where we've got to get to. And even more recently with the Pharmacist 2023 paper, you know, that urgency is it hasn't been more urgent, and that's why I'm quite excited about the future. So the future is exciting, but we've still got a lot of work to convince not just our own workforce but other healthcare professionals about the potential role that we play in the healthcare system.
Amin Javanmard touches on the number of changes that have occurred over his career, including the drop-off in compounding, the increased requirement for skills in counselling, and the rise of discount pharmacy chains.
It's so hard to make a prediction about the future. There's so many different things that could happen. There's so much that's in the air. It can change at a whim. I mean, the location rules changing from being... The change in the pharmacy location rules being going from being every legislated every 5 years to with a sunset clause to being basically in perpetuity until they get changed was one of those things that came a bit out of the blue. What is fascinating now is that we do far less compounding now than pharmacists in the past did. The jobs become changed from being very much physical in that respect to being very much counselling based. So the skill sets changed. You could get away without being able to counsel very much in the past, but now it's very much part of the job description and the professional expectation that you are able to go out there to the patients, explain to them not just about their medication, but a bit about their condition as well, put it into the context. So that's changed. When I got registered, which was in 2008, discount pharmacy was only just starting to become a thing. It has become quite a bit more vicious now. Then it flows back into pharmacy remuneration as well. I think I did an exercise with a student of mine last year, and we compared the average GP dollar per prescription from 1999 or thereabouts to 2016, 2017, and it had halved in nominal terms. It had gone from about $20 per prescription in 1999, $2,000, to about $10 a prescription in 2017-odd-ish dollars. That's without even adjusting for inflation. Once you adjusted for inflation, it was even more a more stark difference. And what was interesting was that that $10 wasn't actually the low point. The low point was right before this current guild government agreement came in, and they were getting down to a little more than what the dispense fee was. So a little more than $6-odd, I think it was about $7.50. So obviously any discussion about where pharmacy is going has got to tie into where the money's coming from. There's been so many services mooted and discussed and spoken about, but a lot of them have relied on patient funding. And notwithstanding the conversation about whether people will pay for it because they think that the service is of value, what hasn't come up is whether people can pay for it. You go to some lower socioeconomic areas, they're all on fixed incomes, everything's rising except for their income, rent, food, utilities, water, electricity. There's the pie's staying the same, but everything else is taking a bigger chunk out of it. So there is a conversation that we're going to have in this country about health inequality at some point, as to whether we are happy for a big portion of the population to miss out on some services because they are not there's no government funding behind it in some way.
Catherine Duggan notes that looking forward to the future requires an understanding of the past, and that moving forward can't hold us to only one path.
I think we can sometimes criticise the leaders of the past without remembering that they might have found themselves in non-ideal situations as well. And to be a bit empathic when we look back at how they chose to forge our paths for us. But also, while we're in our present and future states, to understand that you don't want to pin that road, take Graham's analogy even further, you don't want to pin that road down to be a single lane road, that you want to have scope and breadth in that road so that you can perhaps overtake, perhaps, you know, add junctions, perhaps do some bridging around different circumstances and situations. Medicines aren't going anywhere, but the way we use them needs to be judicious and appropriate for the patients that we are faced with, and we need to think in our heads about the antimicrobial crisis that we're in. And if we looked at that, that crisis, and adapt that to how we manage patients with pain or how we manage patients with chronic conditions that are non-communicable, I think we would be better placed to be the medicines experts of the future. I also think, if you look at the stats, and I think I mentioned this yesterday, medicines aren't going anywhere, patients are getting older, so we're going to see more and more and more medicines. But wouldn't it be great, instead of prescribing more and more, that we get it to an optimum number, and that we would be able to manage that in a really effective and efficient way? So I think we do run the risk of using too many medicines either in a stepwise or in a cocktail fashion, and we should be thinking about what's the minimum we could get away with for the maximum benefit for patients. Could be a good way of thinking about it. I don't see the profession's importance diminishing in the future. I see, if anything, it's going to get even more important. And it might be worth us thinking that it should be in our gift to be the drug discoverers of the future, the new molecules that we don't know about yet, all of those natural products that we have, perhaps not as abundant as we used to, but they are just, you know, a rich forest for us to go and capture from. So that's my view, is it's all to play for.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of the AJP podcast. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions about this episode, please visit the AJP forum at ajp.com.au and join the conversation. If you have any suggestions for future topics or would like to participate in the podcast, please send an email to ajppodcast@appco.com.au or follow us on Twitter @ajppodcast.